both you guys are welcome to, as I understand Patty's going to be recording it. So we're going to be dating, roughly speaking, the morality of capitalism and socialism for target time is 90 minutes. We're going to start with a roughly 3-minute introduction of you guys' positions on it, and then you can go ahead and really just have a conversation, debate, however you guys really want to phrase it. I obviously, you know, keep it civil, but I don't think either of you guys have any issues with that. And after the introductions, I'll step back, let you guys just basically have a conversation, and I'll only step in if needed. So the reasons why I think I would need to step in are generally speaking for, you know, insults. If someone's like interrupting, yelling over the other, I don't think any of that's going to happen. Or if there's, you know, if there's like a gross difference in time, if one person is speaking much more than the other, it's a little bit unfair. So I'd step in a bit for that. But it's really up to you guys. Anything you guys want to clarify before we get started here?
No, I think that's all good for me.
All good here.
And more ping before we start. And get the recording up. Oh, right. And, I mean, if you're interested, you can look in, Keith, in debate night chat. That's for all the users in chat if you want to discuss as we go along. We've got two people that will be debating this, but you guys are welcome to discuss in debate night chat. If for any reason either you guys feel you need to put in a source for something, put in there. I'll pin it if you want to post something there so it's easier for everyone to see. But for the most part, I don't think we should be going too much in depth for sources. It should just be like, you know, I'm saying this thing, it's a quote, and it's not bull crap. Here, it's not bull crap kind of thing. Most of you guys can just go at it. So without any further ado, we've got here Bill Martin from the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And we have Keith Knight, anarcho-capitalist YouTuber under the name Voluntarist. And we're going to be debating the morality of socialism and capitalism. So, Keith, would you like to start and give us an introduction to your thoughts on this?
Sure thing. My name is Keith Knight. I run the Don't Tread on Anyone YouTube, BitChute, Library, and Minds channel. I advocate anarcho-capitalism. This is a moral case that we should have a system of anarchism, an meaning without, archon meaning rulers, no person having the right to rule or initiate aggression against a peaceful person. To do so is to claim a higher right or entitlement to their body, time, or property than they do. And as an advocate of capitalism, what I advocate is a social system based on the explicit recognition of private property and non-aggressive contractual exchanges between private property owners. This is in opposition to socialism, which I would define as the institutionalized aggression against private property and voluntary agreements between consenting adults, and communism, the eventuality of that being the abolition of private property. My moral case is that people have the right to do whatever they want with their own body and property so long as they do not initiate fraud or aggression against peaceful people. Both of these violate the consent, which I see as the root of morality. It's the difference between slavery and a job, theft and a trade, rape and lovemaking, spending time with people, and kidnapping them. I see consent as the root of morality. We also have the economic case. So we also have real-world examples of capitalist societies or societies with a higher degree of property rights recognition and voluntary exchange than societies that engage in socialism or the institutionalized aggression against private property and free trade. Examples would be West Germany having much more wealth than East Germany, South Korea being wealthier than North Korea, Chile being wealthier than Venezuela, Botswana being wealthier than Zimbabwe, and the Dominican Republic being much wealthier than Haiti. This is a constant theme we see on multiple continents, that when people are free, they have more abilities to make voluntarily, mutually beneficial exchanges with one another. We also see a great deal of equality in the idea of anarchism and libertarian free marketeering. because in this system, no person has any rights that anyone else does not have. Whereas if you have a government, some people have the right to make laws, others have the obligation to obey them. If they don't, they get put in a cage and shot if they resist. I will say this is a falsifiable theory, because all you have to do is explain why the state, a group of people called Congress or Parliament, has rights that no other organization has, or you have to explain why it's morally justifiable to initiate violence against a peaceful person. Thank you.
All right, and Bill?
Hi, my name's Bill Martin. I'm in the UK at the moment, and I'm a speaker for the Socialist Party of Great Britain. And we would generally say that we would disagree with the idea that there is a distinction between socialism and communism. I would use the words interchangeably, but since I'm on this platform, when I say socialism, you could equally hear communism. About 20 years ago, when I was first starting out being angry that there were people wrong on the internet, I spent a lot of time arguing with an anarcho-capitalist on a forum. And after many years of arguing, we kind of came to an agreement that we both had honourable positions, but somehow we could never agree fundamentally. There seemed to be some sort of hidden missing premise, so that if we looked at the same facts, we would just disagree on what we were seeing. And then obviously we parted ways. So I'm not here and I don't really want to argue past Keith. What I would like to do is to explore the gap and see if we can find some fundamental premises and discover where the differences lie. And I think from his setup, I could spot one or two points that match my preparation, such as it is. I would define realism slightly, freedom slightly differently as self-realization. I think consent or will or choice is a slightly narrower definition of freedom. So I think that's one starting point. And I would argue with, alongside Karl Marx, that freedom requires property and the ownership of property to be meaningful. And I think the point of divergence from there on in would be that I think that generalized individual property is not possible, and therefore the only way forward is some form of free association around collective common property in order for me to be free. And I think the other point we would disagree on, I suspect, is our definition of capitalism. So I think, and this is, I think, important because I would begin with as a definition of capitalism. It's the Oxford English Dictionary, I believe, defines it as a system in which benefits capitalists, which is a bit of a circular problem. But if you dig a bit deeper into that, you get to the fact that it's about capital. And we need to agree what capital is. I think this is from Smith. The example is of some apples by an orchard owner that he gives to some workers who then bring in the crop of more apples. So it's a stock of goods that's used to increase its own magnitude to become greater through the medium of exchange. And you'll see from that very rough and ready definition, I haven't included free markets as a defining characteristic of capitalism, because it is possible we can imagine a bandit standing there telling the owner of goods that they have to sell them to another person. And as long as the price that that person has to give is greater than the price that the original owner had to pay, then a profit is made. And the basic essence of capitalism has been obtained. And I think that is the basis of where I'd like to start from. And I'd like to develop from there to the idea that capitalism produces the capacity for the trend to reduce the prices of consumer goods to as close to zero as makes no odds, or at least to where it is more expensive to charge for them than it is to actually just give them away for free. And at that point, we are faced with the choice to come to the as it were, moral theme of the evening of, do we reimpose scarcity, or do we go on to a relative overabundance and superfluity of goods in which people can take from a common stock freely in order to develop themselves? And I think that is very, very in a nutshell, given we've got plenty of time to expand on these points, the case for socialism.
Okay, now that you guys have both made your introductions, Keith, Bill, this is the point you guys want to start with. Go right ahead. I'm just going to sit back, and you guys can have this discussion on your own.
Well, thank you. So I want to start off with the definition of capitalism or something, a social system that exists for the benefit of capitalists. Yes, it certainly does benefit some capitalists, but it also benefits some employees. It benefits some children who are not working at all because they reap the benefits from other organizations. There are also the vast majority of capitalists or entrepreneurs that lose in capitalism or do not necessarily make a profit. We see this statistically, just verifiably, that most businesses do not fully succeed. They're not even profitable for the first 4 or 5 years. So the idea that some group benefits and that's how we determine the legitimacy of a system, I do not regard as legitimate. It would be like saying freedom is defined as the benefit of people with really good singing voices, because in a free society, the people with really good singing voices make a lot of money. So therefore, freedom is when you have a society that benefits people like Adele and Eddie Vedder. I mean, I just don't see that as what makes capitalism unique, because even if it's the workers, the quote workers, as if entrepreneurs don't do any work, or investors, if it's the workers owning the factors of production, well, you can absolutely have a worker cooperative under the definition that I gave. There is obviously such thing as collective ownership. I was part of a commune where it was sort of each according to his need when I was in a rehab center. There's nothing. The reason it was a capitalist enterprise was simply because it was voluntary. No one initiated aggression against private property. So I disagree with the foundation of capitalism. How would you respond to that, sir?
I was quoting the Oxford English Dictionary, and I gave its definition to get to the point where I was wanting to get to, which is that the real definition of capitalism lies in the notion of capital itself. I would disagree with one of the things you said, that investors work. The point is that a capitalist can delegate everything. They can delegate the work of being an entrepreneur. They can delegate management. They can delegate investment even. The one thing a capitalist cannot delegate is ownership. In the end, what a capitalist in essence does is they own. If individual capitalists, as you say, go bankrupt, go bust, it is about the centrality of capital as the driving wheel of the economy, placing itself almost like in Stockholm syndrome style above everything else. So we have over here a lot of politicians say that, you know, if you want to have public benefits, you have to have a sound economy. And so they're basically telling us that the only way that we can have anything in our society is if the capitalists are making profit. And now we would define this as the laws of no profit, no production, no profit, no employment. And that fundamental premise of saying that the people who own society have to make a profit before anything can happen is the real essential key core of what I would call capitalism.
But wouldn't that also apply with a worker cooperative? For example, wouldn't the worker cooperative constantly be seeking to reinvest in its infrastructure, make better products, continue to market to more customers, and seek to make more money than they did investing? For example, it costs me about 50 cents to drive to work, and I make about $100 a day, give or take. So I profit $99.50 as an employee. That is in no principle different than an investor making money off capital. Again, the idea that investors don't work, it takes so much intellectual effort to find the right people for the right decision, to make the right choices at the right time for the right reasons. That, I mean, if it were so easy, I would just do it and everyone else would do it. It's extremely difficult. And that's why you see companies go out of business all the time, because it's not that easy. It takes a lot of intellectual effort. I don't see the principal difference between worker cooperative seeking profit, an employee seeking profit, and a capitalist or entrepreneur seeking profit. Do you see a moral or economic difference between those?
sorry, I should say, by the way, I've got a very persistent cough that I can't get rid of. I'm trying not to cough into my microphone, so apologize. just to reiterate, I mean, on the investor, yes, it is very difficult for an investor, and it does take a lot of intellectual effort. However, there is such a thing as power of attorney. So you can imagine an owner in persistent vegetative state who does nothing at all except have other people act on their behalf and do all of that intellectual work. They still remain the owner and they still remain the beneficiary of the interest. And it's a bit like the Inca king, Inca mummies. When the great Inca died, there was the principle that the Inca was immortal. So they mummified him and his court kept on behaving as if he was still alive. He just couldn't handle the idea he was dead. And so in essence, the capitalist is an Inca mummy. They don't have to do anything at all. I would say that there is no difference in a worker cooperative. If it is in producing goods with a view to making a profit through exchange, it is engaging as a capitalist enterprise, and it is following the logic of capitalism. I would say that a worker having to pay to go to work is not making an investment, that they are basically giving money to their employer. As it were, they have to get there in order to get the money at all. They are not making a good that they're exchanging. That's a sunken cost, in essence. So I should say, obviously this has to quote, when we talk about socialism, we are talking about a moneyless, classless, stateless society. So in which it becomes impossible to make a profit in this sense, because there is no way of exchanging with a view to profit. There is simply producing goods that are then consumed and distributing them effectively free at the point of consumption.
Okay. And yeah, as I mentioned, there's nothing wrong with producing something at no monetary cost. It's virtually impossible to do it at no cost. For every second you spend doing something, you are engaging in a cost. That's 1 second you're not doing something else. So money is much more of a reflection of costs than just the existence of costs. I don't see that the moral difference between an employee earning a profit and a capitalist. What if the capitalist hires an employee and loses money on the employee? Did the employee take unjustly or engage in lack of profit, therefore theft, as the vast majority of businesses that are non-profitable? I mean, is it wrong if the capitalist doesn't benefit from the employee?
Just 1 second. So I think this is a good point to introduce the theory of wages. I would argue quite strongly that we're not paid according to the work we do. We are paid according to the commodity cost of our ability to work, and which you can extrapolate as the cost of basically getting how difficult it would be to get someone else to come and do the job for us. So there is, if you want, no moral question in terms of you sell a commodity, you sell it at its market price. And the capitalist does with it as he would want. Marx's own example is to compare it to hiring a horse. When you've hired the horse for a day, you ride it where you want. When you've bought a worker's alienated labour power for the day, you direct their labour power where you want for the day and you reap the returns or take the failures. In terms of, I wouldn't see it as necessarily a moral difference between the worker and the capitalist. I think that the distinction I drew out is that the worker is not producing a commodity that they are exchanging with the capitalist. The worker comes and directly sells themselves and their ability to work. They're not alienating, not mediating it through a commodity that they're then selling onwards. They are the commodity, as it were. So that I think is the key difference. And the point is that, again, the direction if the capitalist is losing money, the system overall will demand that someone somewhere makes a profit. The law of no profit, no employment will come along and eventually say, okay, fine, this firm has made so little money, it goes bankrupt, out it goes. And it's replaced with a different one, no matter how useful the goods it's producing are or how necessary. And I agree absolutely, by the way, that there is never going to be absolute zero cost of production. I think it's the point where it becomes implausible and too expensive to start to reclaim the cost. So as the old phrase went, electricity too cheap to meter. When goods fall below, are so common and so available that it just becomes prohibitive to start charging people to get hold of them. And it just is. Someone wrote a book a few years ago, or well, many years ago now, called Free is Cheaper, in which the essence is, when you take out all the extraneous costs that are built into a commodity now to prevent people getting their hands on it, if we took away those costs, you know, the police, the army, checkout assistants, the security guards, and then, you know, all of the panoply of accountants and stock control devices that are there just to stop people taking the goods from the shops. If you get rid of them and just produce enough to match the demand, then effectively they would be freed. So what we're talking about realistically is, and we can quibble about it, I've never been able to work it out totally scientifically, but we use a rough estimate of about 10 hours work a week each. But if you could be told you would do 10 hours work somewhere that's useful work, producing goods, and what you get in return for that is free access to all the goods that everyone else has produced, that is the case. That is the argument that we make for socialism, that that's the quid pro quo. There is a cost, we have to do it, but capitalism as a capitalist basis cannot provide that level of abundance, and it would step in and reimpose scarcity. And that means denying people the things that they need.
That is something I am certainly skeptical, but I know very little about what humanity can achieve when billions of minds are working together. So please, I would love to see that. You put every capitalist out of business by having employees that work 10 hours a week and then get unlimited access to goods and services. I think that's fine. I don't even think work is necessary for income, just as you could be an investor who just invests in the stock market. That's a way of making money. Or you could be a Social Security recipient who just does not work and just has income because they have previously invested their money elsewhere. So, but again, I don't see actual physical labor being necessary for reaping goods and services. I think that's totally justified, whether you're an investor or a Social Security recipient, which is the American retirement program that the state has. I'm against it because it's involuntary, but certainly a voluntary aspect of retirement programs where you get money by doing no work at all. I think that's totally fine because it's rooted in consent and voluntary exchange. I would absolutely love to work 10 hours a week and do the rest engaging in philosophy and art. Please set that example. Show us how it can work. I'd be more than happy to emulate it and participate in it. I think that we've made our case clear about the relationship between employee and capitalist. Is there anything else on this topic that you want to communicate to me or the audience that I might have missed?
Well, let me check my notes. I did make some. I will add in that I would argue very strongly that poverty and unemployment are essential factors in capitalism and as essential to the labour market as the whip and the chain was to chattel slavery. And there is this inherent element of coercion. And this is backed up by, and I suppose this is a topic that we might move on to in a bit, the inherent tendency of capitalistic markets towards concentration. So as you've just indicated, firms fail, capitalists become unproductive through competition. And one of the results of that is that there will be an inevitable tendency towards capital concentrating in a few hands and making it impossible for a generalized personal ownership of a small, you know, half an acre and a cow is the phrase.
So I will consider
that sort of level of personal ownership. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry to cut you off there. I thought you were done. So let's talk about equality. I will consider this a sort of different area. So if we I don't think free markets or private property rights, voluntary exchange necessarily create equality. I think they reveal an inequality that already exists within humans. So, for example, I'm trying to think of what percentage of people are as funny as Ricky Gervais or are as good at basketball as LeBron James or or can direct a movie as good as Steven Spielberg or sing as good as Adele or Freddie Mercury. I think this sort of inequality is actually simply revealed. I don't think that it necessarily creates inequality. Certainly, if you have a political system, there's tons of inequality there. Congress gets to write words down on paper. Every other human being has to obey it to according to what the judges say, or else they get jailed. So certainly I don't see the state or any social system that doesn't respect private property as being more equal. You just have different inequalities. I think the best demagogues end up getting to the top instead of the best person who can best meet consumer demand. So I believe inequality is just inherent in the existence of human beings, but maybe we could have a more equal society so long as there are voluntary methods used. I'm more than happy to recognize that as being a method of exchange instead of profit. So I guess the example I would use is if we have this inherent inequality and difference between human beings, the best way, the best social system we could have is one that provides an incentive for the elites, or I shouldn't call them elites, for the 1% of people in a certain field to make it profitable for them to provide access to goods and services to people at lower income levels. So yes, there are yachts and Lamborghinis, but really the way to get rich is to provide something for the masses, whether it's Apple computers, Henry Ford's cars, John D. Rockefeller's oil, Cornelius Vanderbilt's steamships, Andrew Carnegie's steel. The way to get wealthy is produce a product for the masses. So this is a way we can actually benefit from the inequality that exists within human beings, something that is not allowed under socialism because it does not respect the voluntary exchange or private property rights of groups and individuals. How would you respond to that take on equality?
Well, I would certainly agree up to a certain point. Formal equality is certainly not anything that I would recognize as socialistic. I mean, the famous line, I can't remember, is it Oscar Wilde who said it, the millionaire and the pauper both have the same right to sleep under the railway arches. But obviously, only one of them will ever have to exercise that. So inherent within socialism, from each according to their ability to each according to their needs, is a recognition of different ability and different needs. And that's the point that we're aiming to get to. And as William Morris said, why bribe excellence? So why bribe genius? Sorry, if someone is a genius and who has a particular yen to perform, like as an Adele or a Freddie Mercury, they will want to exercise it, come what may, because it will be the burning pleasure and desire of their life. But by the same token, I don't see any reason why someone being good at one thing means that they should be first in every queue, which is what essentially it means to be rich in an unequal society. And so taken as a whole, if we have this freedom where there's no more muting glorious Miltons because they're working, 70 hours a week down the mine or something like that, they can have a time to exercise their mind and be a poet in the morning and a hunter in the afternoon, et cetera, et cetera. It's about the morality. It's about the free development of the human being in all their facets, and recognizing that the only way to be free is if we help each other to be free. That is, I think, possibly a fundamental, or possibly some sort of element of difference. But ultimately, yes, I agree that it's sort of like there is a kind of like the market utopia in which everyone is equal. Which the Smithian free hand will allow everyone to through the market to distribute the goods equally, and according to Smith's theory of wages will be paid according to how pleasurable the work is, and people who are being paid low wages are obviously doing a really lovely job, and people being paid lots of money doing a rotten horrible job that no one would want to do otherwise, leaving aside the empirical refutation of that particular model. At least that was his ideological stance on wages, and it comes back to again my point that Yes, I accept that that is the utopian idea of a free market equality. And it's obviously a rough equality, of course. You know, someone will perform better, someone will perform worse, but roughly the market would even things out, except for when you start applying capitalism, because capitalism is not the same as a free market. You start to get concentrations of wealth, and you start to get an imperative to collect more wealth. And then it's a bit like poker. The short stacks will always, on average, will generally lose to the big stacks. That's the central problem, that eventually having more money and having more capital means that you're going to win the game a lot easier, irrespective of your ability of playing poker. It's a great leveler.
So did you say Adam Smith said there would be equality of distribution of goods?
That's the phrase, the invisible hand would distribute, I can't remember the exact quote, the invisible hand will distribute goods as fairly as if of the market, as if someone had set out to divide them equally or fairly. I think it might be more fairly, but that's the kind of like my half remembered recollection of what the famous invisible hand, because most people only remember those two words. You know, it's the whole point is that it will distribute goods fairly and efficiently, as if someone had gone around and equally handed them out with a measuring device. And that is what the market is intended to do in a utopian sense.
My understanding of the invisible hand is totally different, and I might be incorrect about this, but it has virtually nothing to do with equality or fairness. It simply has to do with the spontaneous resulting result without a single central planner or entity. For example, if we take the flowers that are in front of me in a vase, this is the final result, flowers inside of a vase with water. There was not one person who had the seeds and made the glass and made the cars that got the employees to the glass factory, who built the machines and built the wiring for the machines to build the glass, who then built the car and the tires and the engine to transport them to me. Yet I end up with this one resulting item. The classic example is Leonard Reed's eye pencil. So if we have a piece of wood that is necessary for the creation of a pencil, you have to get the wood. Well, people have to first walk there. Once they're done driving, does one person or one entity make the shoes that people wear? Does one entity make the saw they use to chop down with? Who makes the wood chipper? These are all literal. This is a web of billions of people constantly interacting, which result in something as simple as a case of flowers or a pencil, all without having one central authority being in charge of pencil production. So that is my understanding of how the invisible hand leads to a result. I get that it's not the principled heart of what our disagreement is, but I mean, I've never heard that the invisible hand had something to do with equal distribution or fairness.
Well, maybe someone in the chat can look up the quote for us, and we can come back to it if someone.
Okay. Yeah, my whole point on that is either I don't think that's what the invisible hand is, or I think Adam Smith is wrong. If he thinks freedom and voluntary exchange leads to equality, that's as dumb as him advocating the labor theory of value. He's just wrong again.
I would say that he's agreeing with you to the extent that he's saying that a non-directed, non-coordinated source produces a result without a central organization, which I think was what you're getting to. And your example of this distributed quality of modern production, of course, leads us onto, I suppose, another sort of like moral case for socialism, which is that one's work is any more essential than anyone else's in a capitalist or an industrial economy. So if I could just develop this point very quickly. So the point is that a firm, Bill Gates, would not employ office cleaners, receptionists, minimum wage staff, unless overall he was making a profit out of his firm. And he wouldn't employ them unless they were necessary to the firm. That means that they are as equally responsible for the profits of Microsoft as Bill Gates. They are equally essential because it's a distributed system that depends upon all of these interdependent parts and therefore equally deserving of being able to live well. If I could just labour the point just a little bit, you might, if you were very poorly, want to see the world's greatest surgeon because they would save your life. But you would not want to be dragged along the corridor by your hair by the world's worst hospital porter, have the dates mucked up by the world's worst hospital administrator to find that the theatre is being cleaned by the world's worst cleaner. All of these people, no matter how, people in television series, it's the doctors. They're the most important people in the hospital. But they are just equally as important to this whole distributed network of individuals that produce the outcome that is healthcare. And they're therefore equally deserving of, a just outcome from this distributed effort.
Well, I would disagree with the fact that they are equally entitled to the result simply because what they provide is much more interchangeable than what someone at the top provides. I mean, how many people would be able to create as many products and services at such a low price than Sam Walton, who was the creator of the founder of Walmart, started one store in Arkansas. Now he provides millions of jobs for millions of people and provides products and services to the poorest people in the world. He's done more to cure poverty than any government program ever has, along with Jeff Bezos. I mean, the number of people that can do that is so slim. That's why it makes total sense that they have way more money than everyone else, because a lot of people can do the job of the cashier or the janitor. Very few people can do what he can do. In the same way, very few people can get as many people to attend very few people would pay $100 to see me talk on a stage. Millions of people would do it to watch Jerry Seinfeld talk with a microphone. In both cases, we have a person talking with a microphone. Why would they pay more for Jerry than me? Because the number of people that are as funny as Jerry Seinfeld is just a microscopic amount. So because they themselves individually are much more unique in bringing a large amount of value and intellect into the exchange is the reason they're so disproportionately wealthier. No one's going to pay to see me play basketball. Everyone's going to pay tons of money to see LeBron James play basketball. Even though we're doing the same labor, simply the subjective value that the customers or the bystanders see is what determines eventually, or not necessarily determines, but has a great deal of influence, the primary influence as to how much money the entrepreneur or the individual makes.
Well, I think you skipped lightly over something I think was very important in that piece there, which was we're not paid according to the work we do. Not paid according to what we've
So I worked about 10 hours over the last 2 days to upload videos to my library channel at Keith Knight. Don't tread on anyone. The fact that no one paid me to do that, I got $0 and 0 cents for 10 hours of labor, does not make it unjust or unequal or immoral or a flaw in the system. It's the result of me voluntarily choosing to do something, pretty much knowing what the outcome would be. So the fact that people are compensated differently according to their work, I don't see. I mean, I worked 12 years in school and didn't pay anything. I worked an internship where I got $0 and 0 cents an hour because I valued not the money, because it wasn't there. It cost me money to actually have the job, but I valued the on-the-job experience. I valued the resume. I valued the networking. These are all ways that I profited without any money being involved. Of course, there was negative money because I had to pay for clothes. I had to pay for gas and everything else. So the existence of unequal outcomes for the same labor, back to my Jerry Seinfeld example, is not any reflection on the lack of morality or justification for any social system.
Sorry, pardon me. But just to labour this a little bit more. But the point is, we're paid according to how difficult we are to replace. You're quite right. That's what you said just now. We're not paid according to our performance. Right. We're not paid according to what we do in the workshop. We are part of a vast distributed network. Now, whatever his name, old man Walton, he didn't do that on his own, and he very much required an awful lot of people to do put a lot of effort in for him. And at a certain point, the wealth that he has produced has been made by all those people doing all of that work. And that's the work that they do belongs to him, because he has bought their ability to work for the day. of course, he will only employ them if what the work that they do is worth more than what he's willing to pay them. That's the fundamental bait and switch inequality. And that's backed up by, I mean, you say it's voluntary, but when you've got the threat, the real threat of poverty and unemployment, the two key drivers of the labour market, the Reserve Army of Labour, and the lash of poverty, then it's not a voluntary agreement. It is an involuntary one, because one party will starve if they don't sell their goods. So the justice element here is that we do all the work, and we are just as essential for that work. You know, you might say he's at the linchpin of the team, but you know, it's like a game of, well, I was about to say cricket, because that's where I normally go to for this one. Let's go to basketball, not basketball, baseball. When the batter is out on the field, they're there on their own. And, you know, it's one person, they're facing one ball, and that one ball might well be the one, I know very little about the rules of baseball, but that one ball might well be the one that wins the match, and might be the difference between millions of dollars for the team that wins the league and relegation or something like that. And it's all down to that one individual. But they couldn't have got there and performed in that way without an entire team behind them, each performing their own role, no matter how effective each individual one was as a batter or a bowler or a pitcher. So this is the point that we have, as you've said, we've got this collective distributed production system by millions of people come, and no one can point and say, I produced that car. You know, when I have this discussion with people, often, you know, you need to do it down at Hyde Park Speakers Corner. Someone would inevitably bring up and go, so I made a chair. You know, people always bring up chairs because they can conceive of them as being made by one person, as you've just admirably demonstrated. Wood chippers and planers and all sorts of kit. I mean, other people had to be somewhere in that story, unless you've gone and flinted your own hand axe to make the chair. But no one can point to any good and say, I made that. It's a distributed production system. Therefore, it's one in which, if we're putting in our labour, we should all be able to at least be able to live well out of. And if we can live well out of it, if we have the material basis for being able to put an end to the rationing of imposed scarcity and no profit, no employment, no profit, no production, then I think that is the choice that we should be making.
So I don't see the disagreement on, as far as people doing something on their own. For example, we have solitaire that is pretty popular in America, which is known as a card game you play with only one person. But even that is not done on your own. You didn't make the computer. You didn't make the electricity. You didn't make the mouse that you're playing on. You didn't invent cards. You didn't invent the rules of the game. So yeah, as I said, everything is an interconnected web. Even the thing that, you know, just walking alone in a field, you didn't make your shoes. You didn't make the food that allows you to live so you could walk. You didn't drive the car to build the food. Exactly. I don't necessarily see how this strips someone's ability to not recognize voluntary exchanges that result in people enjoying wealth. For example, I have a phone right here, and I did pretty much nothing to make it. I just got other money that I earned and then exchanged it for the phone. I had nothing to do with the labor put into making the phone, yet I still own it. I mean, I don't see anything necessarily bad about me going into a place with only the result of profiting and getting more from my money than I expected. I profited, they profited, mutually beneficial voluntary exchange. The involving labor and employment is also a mutually beneficial voluntary exchange. I again don't see the principled difference here. I would like to get into the idea that necessity negates a right or a positive right to something. Is there anything else you wanted to say on people not making something yet benefiting from it before we go on to positive rights?
Okay, now let's move on to positive rights.
So, would you say that I have a right to a house?
You have a right to a decent home. And I wouldn't impose a house on you.
Okay. Yeah. That's fair.
You might want to live in a flat.
Sure. Okay. So if I have a right to something, does that and that thing, a living space, that living space only comes into existence as a causal result of the production, labor, and actions of other human beings? Are you saying I have a right to the labor and products and services of other people?
Sorry, I would step back a little and say I wouldn't call it a right. I would say, because rights are transferable in law, I would say that you should be able to access a decent home that has been provided to you through the conscious decision by other human beings to provide enough secure, stable, and comfortable housing for all members of their own community.
I agree, that
might be slightly Jesuitical, but the subtle definition there, the distinction there, I think is important, that it's not a right, because you can't then... I would say that you can't then say, okay, I'm moving out of that house, but I'm going to control who gets to go into it and start extracting rents. But I would say that we should have, if we as a community decide that every member of the community should have a decent home, then every member of the community should have a decent home, and that would be based on the free labor of the Free Association of Producers.
As long as there's free voluntary association, I have no problem with everyone having a house and everyone having food and everyone having health care, whether they do a little bit of work or a ton of work. If it's voluntary, I got no problem with that at all. My whole thing is, if I have a positive right to something, to health care, and health care only exists as a causal result of physicians, construction workers who build the hospital, electricians who keep the electricity going, then that inherently means that they have a obligation legally to build that for me. And if they don't, they are violating my rights. And since they're violating my rights, I get to put peaceful people in a cage and shoot them if they resist for violating my rights. So I think there's a big difference between I have a right to X, a right being I have the right to use force or resistance to stop something from happening, whereas just wanting something to have. I want everyone to have a computer. I want everyone to be happy and have a family and be married, but I would die before using force or coercion or aggression against peaceful people to achieve those ends. If I have a right to something, that means other people have an obligation to provide that for me. Would you agree with that statement? If I have a right, that correlates or corresponds to other people's obligation.
Yes, I would say that is entirely correct.
Okay.
That's what rights are in law.
Sure. So is there any right besides not initiating aggression?
I'm very wary of talking of rights because of the inherent problems that you've just outlined in the concept of that they are an enforceable power in law. I would say that, well, there is generally, you could say that even right to non-aggression is an extrapolation of a right to life and a right to dignity. But what I would prefer to talk about is the free development of the individual, and the classic line from the Communist Manifesto is a society in which the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all, which is essentially, you could, if you want to talk in morality terms, the same as Kant's notion of treat each person as an end in themselves, and as long as you're treating people as an end in themselves and not a means to an end, you are behaving as a free individual, and I would totally agree with the idea that you shouldn't be able to force someone to feed you. It's about a self-active decision on people's side. So I would say that instead of the right to force people to build a hospital, it's saying you can't stop us building a hospital because we need one. We are going to do it because we are capable of building a hospital. We have the skills. We're the people who can do this. And then we're going to freely give away our goods because as part of an understanding that this is a way that we can keep this society going. Because we cannot go back to scarcity and rationing. We will work on this basis. And there's no money, there's no capacity for hoarding these things and turning them into a source of income. for the new owners.
There could still be exclusion in the sense of if we build a, if me and a bunch of other people collect property, allocate it through the homesteading principle of being the first comer, original appropriation, and we build a hospital, do you believe we are morally justified or we have a right to charge people for the services we provide? Before that, I want to just define a right. This is the general definition that I'm going from. When I say that someone has a right to do certain things, I really only mean that it would be immoral for another, alone or in combination, to stop me from doing this by the use of physical force or threat thereof. So, do I have a right to build a hospital with other people and then charge other people for the products and services?
I would certainly say you don't have the right to murder people by withholding essential treatment.
Do I have the right to produce nothing and give no one any services?
Ultimately, if you want to walk away from doing the work and as an individual, but I think as a society, we would have to take, because the point is, it's not about rights, it's about responsibility. And when you have a free society, what people are is they're responsible. And you have to take on that you are now responsible for what you do. And if there is no external constraints, there's no constraint through the profit motive, through accumulating wealth, there's no state turning around and saying, you must do this. You are responsible for your actions.
I totally agree that people are responsible. But so you believe that I have the right to build nothing, give no one a house, no one health care, but it's wrong for me to build houses and build hospitals and then charge for those things, even if I provide them to billions of people as a causal result of me building them and charging for them?
Well, you have a right to harm yourself by doing nothing. I mean, that would be, I think if you sat around doing nothing all day through choice would just be, and you were capable of doing more, would be just a source of pity. I think in terms of charging people, I mean, the point is, it comes back to, again, back to my poker analogy. The point is that the market, the monetary system was started by elites. It didn't spontaneously arrive. It was started by states and crowns, and it's always been inextricably linked in with them. And it's always about the fact that some people have money and they use that to exert their influence and their control through the fact that they have some money in the first instance. The big stacks dominate everyone else. And it's about the social powers. So if you think you have a social power to turn around and start denying people access to the things they need, because, as you say, you didn't build the hospital on your own. The hospital was only possible through the entire collaborative produce of the entire community. And I think it is entirely reasonable for the entire community to then turn around and say, well, we have to talk about how we are going to use our own goods and our own freely directed labor.
So if we look at social power, certainly money or ownership of property or titles to property is a method of social power. So I'm just pulling up. So I'm looking at the Young Turks YouTube page, and they have 5.24 billion views on YouTube. Is the ability to influence public opinion and access the minds of billions or millions of people a sense or a mechanism of social
power? You're a bit breaky uppy there.
I'm sorry about that. So let me ask it again. Young Turks, 5.24 billion with a B views on YouTube. I have, let's just say, less than 5.24 billion views. Is this inequality something that would be morally justifiable in a socialist society?
Right. So first off, I've no idea who these Young Turks are. When you're looking at the Young Turks webpage, I thought you were actually talking about Ataturk.
They are your British Cecil Rhodes agents in America advocating Fabian socialism. I was kidding there. But yes, they are democratic socialist advocates in America, supporters of Bernie Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez. Are you familiar with some organizations having tons of views, billions of views, and others like myself having very few, if any? Is that morally justifiable in a socialist society?
Well, it comes back to from each according to their ability to each according to their needs again. So if you come back to the idea of rational authority. So a rational authority. So Stephen Hawking, you know, if he was came into the room and started talking to me about black holes, I'd go, I thought you were dead. And then I would start listening to what he had to say, because I know that he is the authority on black holes. You know, he literally wrote the theses on them. And therefore, you know, I wouldn't turn around and start arguing with him, and would perfectly justifiably accept that people would listen to him. That is entirely different from state authority and political authority, as you would say, whereby people gain authority simply because of a position or an office. And again, if someone happens to have an ingenious idea, or if you know, our muting glorious Miltons turn into real unmuted Miltons and write you know, something comparable to Paradise Lost, and everyone reads it and everyone is inspired by it and starts to act in the way of that suggestion, that's brilliant. That is what genius is about. That's what genius is for. But obviously, you know, doesn't mean that we turn around and start saying, well, okay, but you can now be first in the queue for everything. It comes down to humans are social animals, and I mean, there's research that shows if you think that someone's on your side, you're more likely to agree with them. So you're more likely to agree with your friends making the same proposition as an enemy. You disagree because your enemy has made it. You know, we are very fundamentally social animals, and we will congregate around our like. But the idea of the free competition of ideas, that's fine.
But doesn't that give a absolutely disproportionate amount of that creates more inequality than virtually anything else? Who can control the mindset, public opinion? Who can control the narrative in society, what people think about, what they talk about? I mean, that is – I would much rather have that than $1 billion, because then I could easily convince people of the moral legitimacy of anarcho-capitalism. If I had billions of views versus the few thousand that I have, I don't see how this inequality is in principle different from monetary inequality. But free market inequality just reflects the inequality that exists in all human beings. There's nothing proprietary or uniquely bad about commercial voluntary exchanges versus where you choose to spend your attention. 1%, there's no way it's even 1%. 0.0001% of people is the demographic that the Young Turks would be in. They're in the top 0.0001% is what I should have said. I don't see this as something necessarily bad. It's bad that they advocate socialism, but I don't see this big inequality where they can have a big influence and I can have no influence. Look, Thomas Sowell is a great libertarian economist. He was trending on Twitter because Kanye West took a screenshot of his phone where Thomas Sowell is mentioned. I've been talking about Thomas Sowell for years and people didn't give him attention. This is a drastic, big inequality, but it's not something necessarily immoral. Would such an inequality be morally justified under a socialist system?
Well, first off, I mean, what you're talking about in capitalism generally is that freedom of the press belongs to those who own the press. And if they are a faction within the Democratic Party, then there is implicitly an awful lot of money being spent, millions and millions of dollars being spent on generating the interest that drives people towards them, one way or another. I mean, they might not be necessarily paid by their page, but implicitly there is an awful lot of money that drives in that direction. I've no thought that in the attention economy, and it's no longer backed up by state power, when it is just people being right or wrong, and where there is this no longer this inequality of access to the means of communication that there is within capitalism, and the you know, the vast propaganda industry that you have based on advertising and literally naked propaganda in the forms of political advertising, and PR and public relations and, you know, image managers and all of that sort of thing, and then, you know, the entertainment industry which have the vast capital costs involved. If you have a more democratic and a free access to the pot of ideas, where you have the basic principle that every human being is free to develop themselves throughout their lifetime, so there's no longer this idea that you have an education which trains you for a job and then you stop, but it's an ongoing process where everyone is entitled to access to the intellectual fruits of society. Then I think that is a fundamental, because obviously, I mean, what this comes down to, and I don't know if it's going to keep coming up, equal doesn't mean the same. Equal just means equally human, equally a member of the community, and having an equal say in how that society will be run. But not everyone will be equally right. Some people will have spoon-bendingly stupid ideas, and they'll be shouted, well, effectively shouted down, because they won't get very far, but they'll still have the capacity to put them forward. And of course, one of the things, I was going on a bit about this one. One of the big problems with the way that so-called democracy is operated in contemporary society is that time is allocated to the winners. So instead of basically the minority should have the opportunity to become the majority, minorities should be given more airtime because they are the ones that need exposure, and majorities need it less. But what happens is that there's a general understanding in the mainstream media that they will give all the airtime, all the mid. I just say mainstream media. I deserve my wrist slapping. In the commercial media, they'll give their airtime to the dominant parties on the basis that they're the ones that have the most people behind them and deserve the time. But I don't think that is a particularly democratic way of organizing the exposure of information.
I still don't see how inequality of influence is us who have much more influence on how brain surgery should be done than I do. There are engineers who have much more influence than I do. I literally have none. They literally have tons, way more than I could ever. I don't see that's a bad thing. There's a very small amount of people that influence how printers are made. It's totally unequal, yet we can all benefit from the existence of printers and phones and microphones. Let's take a narrow example. We have two Churchill historians, David Irving and Martin Gilbert. Under a socialist society, would both of them have equal airtime in promoting their ideas? Would they be entitled to both having the same amount of airtime and public influence?
Would they have the same airtime? Well, I disagree with the premise, which is that there would be an allocation of airtime. I think that there would be a free political, there would be a free debate in which people would, because what you get nowadays is you get this allocation of airtime where you get the stage debate with, you know, one side is yet right, one side is wrong, heated debate, this side of thing. You would have the capacity that they would just be as equal as any member of this community to communicate their views. I'm not going to sit down and say how we would run a television station or run a YouTube channel, because the point is would be that people would democratically decide how to do it. But I would say that the principle I set out before, which is minority views have the right to try and become majorities. But in the case of David Irving, of course, he was a liar. Having someone come out as a liar, I think, would mean that we could just invalidate them from being allowed to join in a discussion between people who are reputable historians or who are genuinely trying to seek the truth.
So people that are generally deemed to be liars or people who use misinformation, exaggeration, or half-truths, those people would not have a place in a socialist society?
I suspect that they would not be able to prosper because they would lack the things that promote these people, which is the inequality of wealth, which is the fact that the minority ownership of the means of communication. They would cease and the limitations on education and of a free flow of information would mean that they would not be able to get that sort of attention that they did within the market society that he managed to gain prominence in.
But isn't
just to be clear, I'm not saying that there will be some sort of bureaucracy that would block them, but I think that in the free flow of ideas, they would just be invalidated out via the fact that people would, as I said, the rational authorities would start to be able to say, well, look, there's no point listening to this guy. And people would understand and listen to the people who do talk sense and are right.
But do you still think people would have the right to produce and distribute books written by David Irving in a socialist society?
If David Irving, well, I think we're, sorry, I just have to be careful here because we're straying towards a topic that's on the banned list for this forum, I believe. I would say that there would be, if he wrote a book and wanted it distributing, then it would be up to whatever publishing mechanisms were available and for editors and other people to judge. But obviously, it wouldn't be put out on a commercial basis.
So it would be put in.
I mean, I work in libraries and we have David Irving books on the shelf. And we had a bit of a debate about whether they should be there. And in the end, they were labeled under the subject of historiography. So people can study them as a subject of history and this is the formation of history. You know, and people would probably have the right to try and have their books lodged somewhere in a public space for the attention economy to help them grow. But obviously, I'm not saying that what I would be against definitely is any sort of, well, there'll be no state, there'll be no bureaucracy to shut people down.
Isn't this a major shortcoming in the socialist or collectivist ideology that does not allow for individual expression to engage in property title exchanges without the consent of a larger group? I mean, for example, if we had this in America, Islam would not exist because it's a false belief system that is not very popular and wouldn't have access to there. Certainly, if it was up to a democratic vote, Islam would be gone. Mormonism would be gone. Christianity is getting close to it being gone if it were up to democratic vote and necessity for truth. So the fact that let's say David Irving was lying, that would outlaw, I mean, what, 80% of books that are on history? I mean, the history is just a set of lies agreed upon. I've never heard a more true statement than that. So look, there's going to be inequality. There's going to be shortcomings.
Well, I mean, start off to take a step back. Okay, you're fading in and out, I'm afraid.
Ugh, I'm sorry.
I got a lot of that. I'll just...
Were you on to my point about... looks like I got the Ethernet cord connected.
I got your general. I'll talk a little bit while you're checking your system. I got your general point that about a David. If it was just down to a democratic vote, which is not what I was saying, that it would be down to a democratic vote. I mean, just as now, publishing houses, it would be built more, I suspect, upon reputation of a publisher, and a publisher would want to, build up its authority, its rational authority, and its imprimatur by saying we will give our imprimatur to as this group of individuals with this editorial board to these types of products. Unlike now, where this is performed by commercial firms, and the vetting is done on the basis of can we make this profitable, or do we have sufficient money to distribute this idea because it's in our interest to do so. So I would disagree that this idea that I'm talking about, suppression of ideas or ideas only being able to come out if they're popular. But I think that if there weren't, David Irving was a rich man with rich backers who helped put his material out. And if we have this just this general idea that people will have to, literally produce goods that are of a sufficiently valid quality. In the Wikipedia style, yes, there are lots of criticisms of Wikipedia, but the general idea that it's set up a set of rules that are based on validation rather than verification, I think is a perfectly sensible idea of how we would be able to continue with community. And of course, the internet will continue to exist, so if people want to shout at the void and put up their website, then they're entirely able to do so.
But would there be an allowance? So if we're not really allowed under socialism to gain great amounts of wealth, even through voluntary exchange, would you be able to acquire a very unequal, disproportionate amount of followers, which allows you to disproportionately influence society, creating the greatest power differential that you could have? Would a massive differential in followers and readers and viewers be allowed under socialism?
Well, I think we are starting to repeat the point, which, as I said,
it's really
rational authority.
Is it yes or is it no? One person gets 10 billion views, the other gets zero. Is that morally justified?
Well, as I've said previously, rational authority is entirely reasonable and fine. And if people find that that what you say is worth listening to, and will therefore follow you or whatever, or find means to do so, then it's entirely reasonable that people who have good ideas are listened to more than people who have bad ideas. And people in a free society would be free to support the ideas. And of course, this does mean, as part of a free society, we would have to say, okay, well, we're going to have to make sure that we have means for disseminating and sharing and comparing, contrasting, and debating information. The whole point is that socialism is about, obviously I've been cunningly working in my poker metaphor. Socialism is essentially poker where everyone can see the hands. That's the difference. Because what we're talking about here is, if you're talking about a game of poker where people are hiding the hands and they're bluffing, well, when we take away the bluff, there's no need anymore for misinformation, for disinformation, for trying to use these to gain a hook or control on power. And all you have is a kind of cooperative game whereby there's no edge anymore.
Okay. I guess we've exhausted that topic. I just want to get into the reality and the source of what real world disagreements would be. For example, in about an hour, I have five guys coming over to my house to perform about 5 hours of labor, and I am going to use money to compensate them. Am I morally justified in doing so now, or would I be morally justified in doing this and performing this action in a socialist society? They're doing yard work, if that makes a difference.
Sorry, pardon me. So there's been an awful lot of talking. Well, you're morally justified now because that's how the system works, and if you want to get anything done, you pay people.
Under socialism.
Well, it's not about being morally justified. You wouldn't be able to because there'd be no money. What there would be that you would have to treat people as an end in themselves and gain their agreement, or have a general agreement that there is people providing this type of yard work service that's necessary for a job to be done. And, you know, in socialism, work would be necessary or enjoyable. I mean, that's the great principle. So there might well be that you'll find some people who enjoy doing that sort of work and will do it because it gets them out of the house and they would just want to have, I don't know if it's sunny where you are, an afternoon in the sun clearing a yard out, because that can be fun. I mean, what people don't like is the fact at the moment is why people hate jobs is very much because of the compulsion to be there and the fear that if they lose it, they lose everything. So if you have a society that's based on genuine free association of labour, then asking some people to come round and clear your yard out, that's entirely reasonable. It falls under the same rubric as going along to the stores and taking some food out. Some people have produced food and put it in the store for you. Some people come around your house and do your yard work. And now, okay, yes, there might be some types of jobs that are so unpleasant and that people wouldn't want to do. And therefore, we'd say in a free society, it wouldn't happen. You know, there wouldn't be an option of trying to bribe people to do them.
Why is that not an option? I have a currency. I have a new currency. And I want to start getting it circulated, and I want to make a voluntary exchange with someone else. Because even though they can get food from the Politburo, there is a shortage, and they want more food. With that, with the money I'm giving them, they're going to buy more than is currently being produced because there's a shortage for whatever reason. Am I morally justified in engaging in this voluntary exchange that involves money and labor in a socialist society?
Well, you'd be entirely free to do so, and they'd be entirely free to accept your exchange commodity. The point would be that we would argue that it's this sort of shortage that, I mean, you see it as necessary to, as again, you come back to, you know, to restore your market economy, you have to have scarcity. So if we're saying that there is no scarcity because we are consistently producing an abundance of wealth for people to have access to, then a bit like, I mean, it's the story of the Lancashire, I think it's the Lancashire weavers. Their employers just couldn't pay them enough to work. They just turned around and said, no, thank you, we're not doing any more work. We don't need any more money. You know, it was a serious problem for the mill owners that the weavers were just turning around and going, well, we've got enough now.
Sir, I'm asking you about a moral justification, not what might happen. I could say, well, under total anarcho-capitalism, everyone's going to be so rich. The entrepreneurs are going to be so nice. There's going to be an abundance of money and labor, and no one's going to be sad. And everything's going to be equal through an invisible hand. There's going to be no inequality. Well, okay, hypothetically, let's say that doesn't happen. Are you morally justified in forcibly stopping me and another party from engaging in a voluntary exchange that involves money, a medium of exchange, and their labor?
Well, as I've already said, there's nothing, there'll be nothing to stop you, except the fact that the relative abundance would mean that you wouldn't want to. That's the point. It's a bit like the same reasons why I don't shoplift. Because the thought never occurs to me, because I have no need to steal from stores, you know. So that's what we're talking about. So, to be clear, my not shoplifting is not a moral choice. It's the thought never comes across my mind to steal, because I have enough, and I don't, you know, it just never even need to think about stealing from shops. Then that's not a moral choice on my part.
But still steal. For example, in America, the biggest crooks are rent-seeking bankers, millionaire politicians, and billionaires who are in the military-industrial complex. They engage in the most amount of theft, the most amount of murder, and the most amount of kidnapping. That is an example of people being totally financially secure, yet their values are so poor because they advocate the institutionalized aggression against peaceful people. They don't respect property rights, the non-aggression principle, or voluntary exchange. So this is an example of people that would have plenty under socialism, but still be totally immoral, to where we'd have to have, or not have to where people might engage in social arrangements that would forcibly or disincentivize this behavior from coming to fruition.
I would start off by, I mean, you've hit onto a point that I was wanting to raise at some point, and I think this is a good time to do it. Starting with, they are obeying a systemic logic. Because what money, as Marx said, without money, greed as such is impossible. Because what money says is, you can do anything with money, as long as you have more of it. As long as you get more, so the drive for money is to get more money. That's kind of like it's central, and that's why behind those institutions. And as you entirely rightly say, because I think that drive would, no matter what sort of, if you know, if you achieved your anarcho-capitalist utopia of your own, institutional drive to get more money would eventually lead to people engaging in acts of non-transactional acquisition. That was, after all, how capitalism was started, through something we call primary accumulation, or David Harvey calls accumulation through expropriation. And eventually it would just become so intensely obvious that the way to make a lot of money, as a one-shot even, would be to steal and apply the use of force. And again, to come back to the poker game, you know, what you might find, you come into the poker game, someone steals your chips. And then says, okay, new rule, no more stealing chips. That's you know, now we just play fairly. But you stole my chips. No, well, you know, that's your tough luck. Because that's how it happened. You know, as people came into the game, they went, okay, we'll take this. That's the point. All these firms, it's not that these people are inherently wicked. It is that they are in a situation where they've got infinite wealth available, and they've got the means to, and also an institutional drive. I mean, one of my talking points I'd bring up would be, which I regularly use, Union Carbide. Now, we know from reports after the Great Bhopal disaster, where I think 40,000 people, or 70,000 died due to a gas explosion, there were people in floods of tears in the Union Carbide central office, absolutely at a human level gutted by what had happened. They understood it was a catastrophe. And then they went out and did their jobs, which was to deny that Union Carbide were responsible, and to disclaim responsibility, and because they had a fiduciary duty towards the shareholders to protect the shareholders' interests. They weren't evil or wicked people. That wasn't a moral choice. That was that they had to do that because that's what their jobs demanded.
Are murderers, rapists, kidnappers, and child traffickers and pedophiles inherently immoral?
Yes. I think if you're looking for any form of definition of morality, then those are the kind of acts that you will find are immoral.
Okay. What would you say is the moral difference between rape and adults engaging in...
I missed out what the adults were engaging in. Obviously, consent is defined in law as the absence of penetration with the penis without consent, in British law, certainly. Although it would have been possible 400 or 500 years ago to rape a woman entirely with her consent. She didn't have her father's consent. And rape was seen in historically as an act of theft. And apologies to anyone out there who's, I know it's a difficult subject. You still there?
Keith, you there?
Shoot.
Well, we've done 80 minutes.
I think that's pretty good.
If Keith can come back, maybe we can just do a quick wind-up.
Yeah. So I don't really want to do this for him, but he's not here. I think I know where he's going with that. I think his point was going to be something along the lines roughly of if rape is wrong because, or sexual assault is wrong because a lack of consent, something about government, I think. I don't want
to. Well, I think it comes to his key premise, which is consent and lack of coercion is the source of freedom, and I would entirely agree. But I think rape is more than just the consent. Consent is just where the law comes in, because obviously, again, I realize gender topic. This consent can be coerced. Or forced, for instance, in the form of prostitution, the mens rea of a client of a prostitute is to have sex with someone who doesn't want to have sex with him, and he knows doesn't want to have sex, because if they didn't want to have sex with him, they wouldn't need to pay. But then consent is given, but I would still categorize that as a species of rape.
I failed to see how it's okay for them to not engage in any exchange in which the prostitute starves to death, but it's wrong for them to engage in an exchange which gives the prostitute money.
I think my starting point is that it's wrong to have sex with someone who doesn't want to have sex with you, and to knowingly do so. And I think that is the key violation. Consent is the outward legal form of that particular crime, but really it's a crime against personhood, and also uniquely again because it is very much about. Provoking physical biological responses in someone else's body involuntarily. So it's you can't really turn around and say that someone paying a prostitute because they would starve otherwise is somehow acting in a noble and disinterested fashion. It's still an act of coercion, and it's still an act of frankly of rape, and using someone as a means to an end rather than as an end in themselves. I don't mean to come all over Kantian, but the toolbox is there and I will use it.
So if a man only sleeps with a woman for her looks, and in the absence of her looks, he wouldn't be doing it, is she effectively raping him because he's only doing it for the looks in the same way the prostitute's only doing it for the money?
He's doing it if he's doing it willingly because he wants to. And likewise, if she's doing it and she does it because she wants to. And they both do it knowing that the other person wants to get pleasure from them. Blake's line, what is it men from women do require? The delineaments of gratified desire. What is it men from women? Which one did I do first? Men from women. What is it women from men do desire? The delineaments of gratified desire. That's the Blakean line. That's what it's about. It's about mutually wanting to please the other person as much as wanting them to want to sleep with you. And I think if you to go further into this sort of like this cul-de-sac, because I think time is short. And I've covered that point anyway. So yes, I think that I'll leave that there.
All right. And I guess my final point would be treating people as ends in themselves. I don't see this as something necessarily immoral. For example, if I look at my phone, computer, laptop, scissors, fan, printer, all of these things were made without me in mind. They just wanted my money. And I only wanted these products. I don't need to be friends with all the employees and transportation individuals that were involved in all of these things. These are commercial exchanges that make us all voluntarily better off mutually, and they all involve only commodities. No one's treating anyone else as an end in and of themselves. Are such commercial exchanges a violation of any socialist principles?
I would say that the point is the concept is commodity fetishism, where relations between people become relations between things. and it should be about the relationship between people. So the people who make the iPhone, if they're making the iPhone because they enjoy making iPhones, because that is what fulfills them and interests them and helps them to develop as, again, to come back to this key phrase, a society in which the free development teaches a condition for the free development of all, or to use Alexandre Dumas' version, one for all and all for one. And who can disagree with that? if people are doing things because it is an expression of their inherent selfhood, then that's fine. But it's instrumentalizing people. It's turning people into mere cogs in a machine that is harmful. Again, I would say it's not necessarily about morality. It stunts people and makes us all poorer. But because obviously, if people around you are mean and pinched, to borrow Lawrence's phrase, then you lose out because they're not creating more, they're not being more, they're not giving more to you. And that's the ultimate crime of poverty and unemployment, is that we are all losing out on all of that ability, all of that wonderful energy and imagination of all these people who are locked in out of being able to control society and have a say in society and produce something brilliant, which is themselves. I'm starting to sound like Doctor Who, aren't I?
we've got only 4 minutes left. I would like to start wrapping this up. If you guys give, like, you know, in like 30 seconds or so, final thoughts and comments. But then also, you know, I know Keith has his YouTube channel, and Bill, you're a member of a political group. If you guys want to plug those as we close up here.
Okay, so I'll go first because you started. so worldsocialism.org, that's our website. And I'm a member of the Socialist Party of Great Britain, but we have affiliates around the world. When I say affiliates, there's a few people in a couple of countries. And I think that I set out to try and bridge some of the gap. And I think that the point that we did come to sort of like agree on is a free, non-coercive society in which people can work and in which they can express themselves is a valid and free way forward. And I think there were some points to further discuss a bit further on down the line, but I think that on the whole, my case, it has been essentially that we can have a free society if we allow the industrial society to produce a relative material abundance of goods so that there is no longer the constraints of money or power, and instead there is the principle of from each according to their abilities to each according to their needs. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me on. again, my channel is Keith Knight. Don't tread on anyone. I will say that at the beginning, I falsified my statement. Any justification for initiating aggression or holding a group called the state to a different moral standard would refute my anarcho-capitalist position. I will say that that has not been done. As far as wanting a society where everyone has abundance, I am totally on board with that. The embracing of each according to his ability to each according to his need does not necessarily render that any more than the private property ethic and voluntary exchange and contracts do. So I appreciate your time as well as the listeners. Again, my channel is Keith Knight. Don't tread on anyone. And thank you for your time again.
Well, thank you guys. This has been good. So if you guys want to check out Social Party of Great Britain and Keith Knight, Voluntarist on YouTube, I know a lot of you have been asking if this would be opened up after this. I'm looking at this now, and so we're going to close up this voice chat. If any of you guys, you know, want to get some words out as you've been listening for over an hour, unable to speak, I'm going to move down to politics too, and I guess continue the discussion in there. And once again, thanks for coming, guys. Really appreciate it.